Please rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
May I please the court?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is an appeal in the Section 220 Books and Records case from an order of the Vice Chancellor that a shareholder, the appellee, Mr. Orloff, is entitled to inspect certain confidential documents of J.W. Mays, Inc., a New York corporation, 45% of the stock of which is owned by the Delaware corporation, Weinstein. I'd like to briefly set the factual stage because that is important to the two arguments I wish to make. The first argument is that the factual landscape has been so dramatically altered by Mr. Orloff's sale of approximately 92% of his holdings that even if he was once entitled to these documents, he no longer is. Then the second argument, which this court need not even reach if it were to reverse on the first, is that the Vice Chancellor applied an erroneous and unworkable definition of the meaning of the word control in concluding that Mays was a subsidiary of Weinstein for purposes of Section 220. Let me first briefly go to the important facts. As I said, Weinstein owns 45% of the shares of Mays. Mays is a public New York corporation, not before this court. Doesn't even do business in Delaware. Mays has directors unrelated to Weinstein, some of whom were designated as a special committee that retained outside counsel and ultimately concluded, after Weinstein asked Mays if it would produce the documents, concluded that it was not in May's best interests to do so. We are here talking about detailed documents like leases, very confidential. In the record is the letter from the Special Committee of May's setting forth the reasons given by the Special Committee for its decision. The confidential documents of May's at issue do not relate to any transactions between Mays and Weinstein, and they are not in Weinstein's possession. All documents Weinstein possesses relating to transactions between Mays and Weinstein have been produced for inspection, along with a number of other documents. Now, at the time of the court's ruling below, Mr. Orloff and his family owned approximately 34% of the shares of Weinstein, and 63% of the shares are owned by the Schulman family. And as the court knows from the record, the Schulmans and the Orloffs are related, and there is a history of contention and litigation, which continues, unfortunately. The Vice Chancellor held that the Mays documents in question were necessary and sufficient to one of Mr. Orloff's stated purposes, and that was to determine the value of his shares for purposes of selling them to JWA, a third party, and that JWA needed them in order to perform due diligence in connection with the purchase of those shares. Now, there was another stated purpose, but that was rejected by the Vice Chancellor. That was the contention by Orloff below, that these Mays documents were necessary to Mr. Orloff's investigation of alleged wrongdoing at Weinstein. And the Vice Chancellor rejected that as a proper purpose, and Orloff did not appeal that ruling. So the only proper purpose we are talking about on this appeal is the purpose of needing to see these documents for purposes of valuing the company or the assets of Weinstein in order to sell the shares. Now, among the relevant facts, the next one is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that is that after filing of this appeal and without seeing the Mays documents at issue, or the information in them, the Orloffs sold approximately 92% of their shares, reducing their holdings down from 34% of the outstanding shares to between 1 and 2%. Those were sold to JWA. And the retention of the remnant of the shares was consistent with the JWA Orloff acquisition plan from the beginning. JWA wanted Orloff to retain some shares. Now I'd like to turn to the first appeal point. Because we are dealing here with a prospective remedy, that is, whether Mr. Orloff should, after this court's determination, have the right to inspect these documents, to see them. The present landscape.
Mr. Lamont, let me interrupt you for a moment. What is the time relationship between Orloff's sale to JWA and the decision of the court on the 220 case?
The court below rendered its decision at a time when the Orloffs still owned their 34% of the shares. There had been no sale. My understanding is there may have been an agreement subject to due diligence.
But there would be, had the opinion been handed down before the sale took place?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. Because we're here dealing with a prospective remedy, that is whether the Orloffs should get their hands on these Mays documents now, present reality, the present landscape is far more important than the reality at the time the Vice Chancellor ruled, that which is, in effect, what Justice Jacobs was referring to there. This is not an appeal about a damages claim for past conduct. And Weinstein's position here is very simple. Had Mr. Orloff sold 100% of his shares to JWA after the court's ruling, we submit it would be unreasonable to conclude that the information Mr. Orloff never saw was necessary, using the standard required, necessary to his decision to sell. Moreover, it would be, in effect, it would moot the issue because he would have no more shares to sell. Now, we submit that the economic consequence or the economic difference between selling 100% and selling approximately 92% for many millions of dollars does not change the conclusion where the issue is, was the information necessary to the sale? In other words, Mr. Orloff has by his conduct demonstrated what we asserted below and lost in a very different factual context, that these particular Mays documents are so tangential to his decision whether to sell that they were not necessary to him.
Is it Mays' conduct or JWA's conduct? I thought the argument was that it was JWA that needed the documents to do due diligence.
I'll leave it to Mr. Jenkins, but the argument as stated in the papers and argued below was both, that Mr. Orloff wanted it in order for him to make a judgment as to what the value ought to be, because it's unclear, we never knew what the deal was that they had subject to due diligence, so whether the price was fixed or whether it was not. Now, in his answering brief, Mr. Orloff states that he is interested in selling the remnants of his holdings to Weinstein. But that response doesn't speak to whether these documents are necessary to that purpose, and we submit he's already demonstrated that they are not, because they weren't necessary to his sale of 92%. And if the test of necessary and sufficient, which is the test under this court's cases, is going to be a meaningful standard, we submit that the decision below that the documents were necessary to his purpose should be reversed. And I say that knowing that the Vice Chancellor had a very different context.
Well, I think the argument would be that it's become moot. I think if he sold 100%, it would be moot. You're saying 92% is the functional equivalent, so we wouldn't necessarily be reversing the Vice Chancellor on the facts before him, but we're saying the subsequent course of events put it in a different posture.
That's precisely it, Justice Thomas, precisely.
Mr. Lamont, was the Vice Chancellor asked to determine whether or not the issue had been mooted by the post-opinion sale?
No, Your Honor. What happened was the appeal had already been lodged, and we moved to remand here, and it was opposed by our colleagues. Now, I must say, in their opposition, there was a mistake, and that was that they stated that that we had conceded below both proper purposes, that is, the purpose that they wanted to value their shares and the purpose of investigating wrongdoing. That was a misstatement, and I don't know whether that had any impact on this court's denial of that motion, but that was just wrong. The court below specifically rejected that second purpose as a purpose, as a grounds for getting these documents.
Well, Mr. Lamont, let's move to one of the other points in your brief. In the interest of time, as I understand it, let's suppose you implicitly acknowledge that owning 45% of the stock, assuming that 100% of the shareholders didn't turn out for a vote, might give you the ability to replace the board.
Yes.
But that under the circumstances of this case, the rule of law shouldn't be that to comply with a 220 request, you shouldn't have to replace the whole board.
That's correct, Your Honor. I have given a great deal of thought to this and struggled with it. In fact, I think the record shows that the Vice Chancellor below struggled with it. He said, well, I see control here in traditional ways, and we do not dispute that the indicia of control, as we commonly deal with it, many of that indicia are here in this case. The problem is that this particular statute is one which, unlike all those other contexts, really requires a definition of control that's practical. That is one which says, okay, you have, not only do you have control, but you have control that will permit you to actually go get those documents and deliver them. And that's where I submit to the court, I think this may be one of the rare instances in which we have a flawed statute. The problem is, of course, that by the remedy that the Vice Chancellor attempted to apply below, it reflects the fact that the finding of control and actual control are something very different, because the court had to resort not to what the statute says, which is go Weinstein, go get the documents, but the court's power here to issue a commission to the court in New York. The court in New York would then bring Mays into court in New York, and we would have a whole other litigation between Mays and Orloff that wouldn't even involve the corporation who is supposed to have control in order to get the documents. And I think that reflects the struggle here. On the other hand, I readily concede that a very practical application of this statute, which we think is required by the realities of the situation, most analogous to the situation where in litigation under discovery rules, a corporation here is asked to get documents, produce documents from an absent subsidiary, as was the case in Frank v. Engel, which was Chief Justice Steele's case at the time. I fully recognize that holding, which is, well, if you're going to look at the realities, then the sub's got to be an alter ego or somehow totally controlled in a way to give the court confidence that the parent can actually get the documents. What that does is substantially constrict the scope of the amendment as it exists. And
The old law worked, and because that was the relationship you needed in place.
That's correct.
And the difficulty you point out in your brief is that you've given them all the Mays documents you have in your possession as a result of your relationship with them.
That's correct.
But if you're now asked to go get the documents from Mays, other than ask and hope they reply, and the only way you can comport with the court's order is to replace the board.
And, Your Honor, I would submit, as we, I agree with everything you've said, but I would also submit that, as we stated in our brief, even that may not do it, because the new board would have fiduciary duties owed to Mays only, which the Vice Chancellor recognized. And that board may say, well, okay, my buddy's put me on here, but I got to do what's right for Mays. And
this court has held in other opinions that once you're elected, you have to discharge your fiduciary duties independent of the people that elected you.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And under these facts, there is nothing in this for Mays. I mean, we're talking about Mays confidential documents given to people who are admitted competitors because a stockholder of another corporation, Weinstein, wants them, even though he sold 92% of the stock. But when Mays made the decision, they hadn't sold the stock. But I mean, from Mays' standpoint, there's nothing in it, and a director, frankly, of Mays would expose themselves more, in my judgment, by giving up these documents than it would by not giving them. Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a question, though, maybe it could wait for rebuttal, but I'm confused by the Vice Chancellor's reference to an attempt to cause Mays to comply in the supplemental order after finding that they had sufficient control, arguably, for them to compel production of the documents. What did he mean, in your view, by the attempt to cause Mays to comply?
Your Honor, that order was drafted by counsel and submitted to the court. I do not recall that we had colloquy with the court about that, but that language was put in by counsel. And I must submit to you, it's because everybody recognized, and certainly we recognized, that all we could do was attempt to do it. We had no actual control or power in order to do it.
Okay.
May it please the court. Your Honor, as the issue in this case started out as what does the law mean? What does Section 220 and the amendments mean? I believe what Mr. Lamont has said here today, I believe what his brief said, indicates that the parties do not disagree on what the words control means in Section 220. We both believe if the court below needs to take a practical look at the facts and decide based on that practical look whether or not there is control as an actual matter. Whether the parent corporation can cause the subsidiary to give the documents.
Well, in this case, how would they do that?
Your Honor, I would submit the facts we have given would say that in every time, except when Mr. Shulman doesn't want it to happen, they pick up the phone and say, ship us the documents. This case, Your Honor, and I think the court below recognized that and discussed it, that the facts show that Mays is controlled by Weinstein and there's very little difference between the two corporations.
And what about this independent committee that was put in place?
Your Honor, I have no doubt that they put a committee in place, and I have no doubt that Mr. Shulman indicated what he wanted the response to be. The so-called independent committee, Your Honor, was chaired by Lance Myers, a lawyer in New York. Mr. Myers is a lawyer for Mays, outside counsel for Mays. He's outside counsel for Weinstein. He is the man who did the negotiations to try to buy out JWA shares once they bought our shares. The idea that he is independent independent in the sense that a Delaware court would recognize for an independent counsel. It's a New York corporation, but the sense he's independent, and that the court below must give deference to what I submit was a charade, as I think is just completely wrong. This corporation is controlled by the Shulman family, this meaning Weinstein, this meaning Mays. Weinstein owns 45.16% of Mays stock, and the court has seen, we've provided the letters, in fact they've provided Mr. Lamont's appendix, where the prior CEO of Weinstein wrote to his stockholders saying, we want to protect our control of Mays, and we're going to buy more stock. They went from 33% to 45%.
Well, help us deal with the point that Mr. Lamont alluded to, and that is that Mays has its own board of directors. I understand under the facts of this case what your position is, so you can assume my question is a hypothetical. But you have a 45% shareholder in my hypothetical, and they call the board on the phone, and they say, send us the documents. And the board said, well, we think in the proper exercise of our fiduciary duties, we're not going to do that. What happens next?
Your Honor, if that is not a charade, if it's a good faith exercise, then the parent corporation can, under New York law, bring its own 220 action. It doesn't have to replace the board. And in fact, I think you will see in the language of Section 220, it says, has the ability to get the documents. Well, their own, I don't know what the New York corporation law's 220 provision is. I believe it requires 5% ownership. They have 45%. They could bring that at.
Now, I think it's you're suggesting in this case what the vice chancellor should have done is said to Weinstein, all right, you've asked, and they said no. And they're not before the court, but you are. I, the vice chancellor of Delaware, order you to bring a 220 action or the equivalent against Mays.
I think, Your Honor, what happens is first they have to ask, and they didn't. They have never asked. That's what happened is this committee was created when he gave his preliminary indication in April. They had a committee, and the committee came to the what I found a completely unsurprising conclusion is no, 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 they didn't want the documents to be produced. Now, if this was really good faith in the real world by a subsidiary, recognizing that a stockholder of the parent corporation for a subsidiary that's a substantial amount of the net worth of the parent corporation does have an interest in trying to understand the value of that, especially a very thinly traded company like Mays. Mays trades by appointment. Its market price, this court would never recognize in an appraisal action as indicating what its fair value is, especially because it's a real estate corporation. To understand that, you have to understand the leases and the other things that it has.
Well, what we're trying to sort out here is this amendment to the statute that talks about control, and we can talk about control of the subsidiary, but then we need to get to the practical control of the documents. And you seem to suggest that if you're controlling the subsidiary in the traditional sense, even if you're not controlling the documents, you need to exercise your control in the traditional sense and do whatever it takes, including bringing other lawsuits or electing new directors to get the documents.
It might take that, Your Honor, but first it would take from the court below wasn't presented that. This court has presented a hypothetical because as Weinstein never tried. Now, if Weinstein came back and said, we did X, Y, and Z, and we couldn't get it. And here's all the good faith things we did. Then the court below would have to, as a court of equity, as the Chancery Court, make a decision on the practicalities there. That's it, and what the inherent equitable power is, just like it always does.
Well, and how did the committee get established by Mays, and how did the committee give this answer? They did this on their own after the ruling?
They were before the ruling. There was a preliminary ruling in April, but it was not final. They created a committee, and the committee came back and said, no, we're not going to give the documents. Now, I would submit, Your Honor, in the real world, normally, because documents like these, lease documents, they're subject to subpoenas. They are not They're not the formula of Coke. They're not nuclear secrets. They're subject to subpoenas. They're routinely produced in other kinds of litigation. And if they say that they can't let this go to JWA because they have important interests, the chance to recognize maybe they do. Personally, I doubt that they have those interests, but okay, we'll go along with that. We suggest it, fine, produce them to counsel for JWA. Counsel for JWA is Stuart Shapiro, this court knows. Mr. Shapiro's a member of his bar. Let him review the documents. That would protect JWA. That would protect Weinstein. Everybody would be protected. In the real world, people acting in good faith, that would be at least considered. But we didn't have that here. Instead, we had a preemptive, we're not giving the documents, you've got a criminal on your organization, you're a competitor, which is kind of silly. There's, I don't know how many buildings in New York, and saying that they're a competitor is a little silly, but in any event, everything they said could have been taken care of by other means, but we never got there. We never got there because instead this went on appeal. And the other question of, well, when is this allowed? Below, my friends argued, this statute can't apply to a non-wholly owned subsidiary. It clearly does because the definition of subsidiary says it's either wholly or partly owned. We're here now, and we're now debating what the court would have the power to do, how to exercise the control, all in hypothetical. But, Your Honor, I submit that Vice Chancellor Lamb had the facts in front of him, showing him, and I think clearly showing him, that this is Mr. Shulman doesn't want to show his cards, and his friend Mr. Myers, the head of the special committee, said, no, we can't do this. Now, Your Honor.
Well, and I understand that's your point. But if you look at the Vice Chancellor's ruling in his colloquy, he goes on to say this could be problematic. And he says that two or three times. And you would think if it was so clear to the Vice Chancellor that this was a charade, he would have, rather than say this is problematic, he would say this might be problematic in other contexts, but in this case, I want you to pick up the phone and get the documents.
He certainly could give an order and they'd come back with whatever they would come back with. But if it's problematic, Your Honor, it's maybe they don't come back with the good faith answer. And proving that can be tough, and then you have to have...
No, I understand that. You're suggesting that this case is so clear because of these relationships, the Vice Chancellor saw it, and that's why he ordered what he ordered. And from an appellate perspective, what I'm saying is, we're reading the record, and what we've seen the Vice Chancellor saying is, when you've got 45%, it may not be an easy thing to do, but this is my ruling, produce the documents.
And that should be the ruling, and then if they can't do it, then they come back and say, we can't do it because X, Y, Z, and then he can decide what relief to give. If there is relief, one of the forms of relief we believe he can get, but it's premature. He has to have a hearing. He could go and he could issue a commission. He could ask the New York Supreme Court to order Mays to produce the documents. He could create a hearing up in New York, but that's the price of federalism. I don't think that's a fairly big issue. But does he have that power? I would say absolutely. I would say the Delaware Chancery Court needs that power, has that power, if he believes he's getting the runaround. But we don't know that yet because it hasn't been decided. Weinstein's never come back and said they couldn't get the documents. All they've given is the Mays. Now, I think one of the...
I didn't hear the rest of your sentence. All they've what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I slurred my words and I didn't finish the sentence. All they've done is given the Mays letter and said, the letter from the special committee saying we don't want to produce these documents. And they've given him that, but Weinstein hasn't said what they've attempted to do to get the documents or how they've attempted to work with Mays to create a situation where, in good faith, the documents could be, for example, reviewed by Mr. Shapiro.
If someone tells you we're not giving you the documents before you ask, and you know we're talking about mootness, it makes the request kind of moot. What would you have them do in view of this letter?
Your Honor, if they were operating in good faith, what I would expect them to do under an order from the Court of Chancery is to call up this special committee and say, okay, you say you're not giving these because you're worried these will get to people you don't like. The other side has proposed that Mr. Shapiro review these. Are you willing to do that? That doesn't ask for them too much, and I think they have a duty to do something like that to comply with this order.
I now understand that as is not uncommon, that lawyers drafted the supplemental order that the Vice Chancellor signed, although I have a tendency to assume that he read the words before he signed it, and he had some understanding of what he meant in his supplemental order that said attempt to do it. What is your understanding of, particularly if you agreed to that language when it was submitted to him, what's your understanding of an attempt to comply?
I believe I drafted those words, Your Honor, and I hope. And
well, so I've come to exactly the right place.
The right person, and perhaps I've created confusion by doing that. I think they have to go back to Mays and make a good faith attempt to comply with this court order and to say to Mays, okay, we understand your points. Ains.
Well, why, if you have found that the controlling interest can make it happen because they're in control, do you then say to him, attempt to do it? That suggests you have some well-founded reservation that they're going to be able to get it done despite that level of control. And is that the type of control that the statute speaks to?
I don't have any doubt, Your Honor, that they have that control. I don't think the Vice Chancellor had any doubt they actually have the control. But
why do I, because he used the term attempt to do it? Why do I have a doubt? Why shouldn't I have a doubt?
Because, Your Honor, I think in putting an attempt, it doesn't undercut the finding of control, but it recognizes, they say, well, for today we don't control. Fine. Come back and tell me, hey, try it, and then come back and explain to me why you couldn't do it, and then maybe he will be convinced they don't have that control. I don't think that's I don't think that undercuts the finding that they actually control. But it recognizes what they're saying, well, we can't control it. And I think a court then says, you haven't tried it, go try it. I think you have that ability.
So he makes a finding that the entity does have control. And then he enters a supplemental order that recognizes that they may not, therefore he says, attempt to exercise that control, and then come back and tell me why you didn't have sufficient control to do what I ordered you to do.
Your Honor, I understand.
I'm having difficulty with that.
I understand what you're saying is there is a possible logical disconnect between the two. So, if there is, Your Honor, the fault, of course, lies with me as the drafter.
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting that within the court's ruling, he consciously signed this language for a reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not simply because you drafted it and it was submitted to him. It's suggesting to me, perhaps incorrectly, maybe I'm inferring the wrong information, or intuitively I have this wrong, but it suggests to me that he knew there would be some practical difficulty with his definition of control under these circumstances, under this statute, and his supplemental order recognized that.
I think he recognizes the fact that, Your Honor, he has a special committee come back and say, nope, this would hurt Mays, and we don't believe we should do it. He has that fact out there. He believes, in fact, Weinstein controls Mays. I believe the record shows he has grave doubts about whether the special committee was set up or not.
Let's try to find the Machiavellian plot of the subcommittee and talk about how the statute is going to work as amended, because it would seem that we need a definition of control where you either have control or you don't have control. And if you have control and you're ordered to comply with a request because you do have control, it would seem the documents ought to appear as a matter of course. And if you have control as defined here, and you can only exercise it by having satellite litigation, doesn't that create a question about whether you had control?
May I start off by respectfully disagreeing with Your Honor's use of the term Machiavellian? I don't think it's Machiavellian in the sense that there's a big plot. I think it's just realism, and I think there's a difference, and I think that gets right to Your Honor.
Machiavellian wasn't meant in a pejorative sense. But collusion, or you're suggesting to us that the committee really wasn't independent and didn't exercise independent judgment, and that it was a setup, I think, was your word. So what I'm saying is, putting aside in this case that this committee was a setup, in some future case, if we go with this definition of control, we may run into a really independent committee. And my question to you is this a workable definition of control if, in order to produce documents from a subsidiary, it's impossible to do it without satellite litigation?
I'm not sure it is impossible to do it, Your Honor. It depends on the reaction. But I would say, Your Honor, and I think what Justice Lamb said meant when he said that this might be problematic here is there can be a lot of ranges of reactions on these situations. There will be times probably when you just get the documents. And there will be times when the parent doesn't want you to get the documents and either gives a wink and a nod or a phone call and gets a subsidiary not to produce them. There'll be other times when the subsidiary is completely independent and won't produce them. And could that produce litigation? Absolutely, Your Honor. That, however, is done by the statute. That is something the statute presents to the courts. It does not provide a bright line in every circumstance. What it does is it means there's going to be more work in these cases.
Do you know anything about the legislative history beyond what we see in the briefs? What was the origin of this amendment?
The origin of the amendment, I think it came out of Scholes versus Admiralty Enterprises and then a number of more recent Chancery Court cases where the chancellors were trying to look at when a subsidiary's books and records could be produced. And there was not consistency there. And I think then the Corporation Law Committee, which recommended this to the General Assembly last year, was asked to take this under advisement. And there was a great deal of discussion and a great deal of disagreement. Some of the disagreement came on, though it's not written anywhere. It was precisely, well, what's a subsidiary and what's control? And I think it was left in the end to decide it on a case-by-case basis with this language. I believe the drafters of this knew, I've run out of time.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Jenkins, this presents the second case today that the Chief Justice suggested might be a good bar exam question.
I'm glad to participate in one of them.
It also suggests that inconsistencies in court opinions might not be fairly resolved by statutory amendments.
May it please the court. I want to disagree with Mr. Jenkins about an important fact. Mays was asked. And in fact, this notion of there not being a spirit of cooperation here, we went to Mays when we went to Mays precisely to try to move this situation. There was a special committee formed because there was a request by Weinstein. And I personally was involved in that request, so I know about it. And
is the request something we can find in the record anywhere?
I'll try to find that, Your Honor. I cannot recall whether it is at this point or not. But it was just so obvious to us. I mean, there was no reason for Mays to just do this without Weinstein saying, look, we're in Delaware, here's the situation, please do it. Also, Mr. Jenkins liked to talk about, you know, the real facts and reality. The Vice Chancellor didn't make findings that this special committee was a sham or anything. He made no findings like that. In fact, I thought he was quite respectful of the problems Mays was going to face. And if we're talking about realities, one of the things that Mr. Jenkins avoids talking about in terms of a reality is that Mays has public shareholders, and that's what is the key to, in my judgment, Mays' reluctance here. There is nothing in this, nothing, that Mays can look at and say it's in Mays' interest to produce these documents. There's only risk. And Mr. Jenkins would say, well, they should be good guys. They should do it because Weinstein wants them to do it. With respect, that's just not facing that reality. Now, the only other point I wish to make is that with respect to, well, let me say that with time left, unless the court has questions, I'm thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen.